Ambassador Kanye today on The World. Just kidding. We're not covering that. I'm Carol Hills. We are covering a dramatic spy story. A suspected Chinese spy is in a U.S. jail. American agents lured him to Belgium.
That allowed the authorities to arrest Mr. Xu while he was not in China, in a country that had an extradition treaty with the United States.
Yan Zhengxu said he worked for a think tank and he'd invite U.S. defense contractors to China to give talks.
And then once the employees were brought to China, they'd be wined and dined, whereas we all know people can maybe be a little bit too forthcoming with information. And at the end of the day, he was also looking for employees who at least seemed amenable to giving him information that they shouldn't.
That story today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. A Saudi journalist is missing and presumed dead. The details that are coming out about how Jamal Khashoggi may have died are both gruesome and something out of a novel. A Saudi government hit squad lying in wait inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The kingdom strongly denies the accusation, but there's outrage around the world, including in Washington.
Well, we're looking at it very, very seriously. I don't like it at all.
That's President Trump on Fox News this morning.
And we're being very tough, and we have investigators over there, and we're working with Turkey, and frankly, we're working with Saudi Arabia. We want to find out what happened.
The Turkish government disputes that U.S. investigators are working with them, and the question remains about just how tough Trump might be with the Saudis. It's a key relationship for the U.S., and Fawaz Jerjez of the London School of Economics says the consequences would be huge if relations become further strained.
What you have is an American president who views the world through the lens of business and profit, who prioritize money and resources over human rights. He has made it very clear that the Saudi-American relationship is very strategic. What's involved are hundreds of billions of dollars. He's unwilling to break up relations with the Saudis. But what you're going to see is a great push by the American foreign policy elite, both Democratic and Republicans, and you're going to see some major consequences when it comes to arms deals between the United States and Saudi Arabia, and also probably a vote in the U.S. Senate against U.S. support for the war in Yemen, and overall an anti-Saudi sentiment that permeates the American political and social establishment.
This story is just kind of unbelievable. I mean, let's just say it. You mentioned Congress, and I imagine Congress putting an enormous amount of pressure on President Trump. What is so critical about this relationship, the U.S.-Saudi relationship? It just seems like this is, if true, an unspeakable thing that's occurred, that something has to happen.
Keep in mind that if the evidence is correct, and it seems to be correct, that the Saudi authorities either kidnapped Jamal Khashoggi or kill them. This is an act that speaks volumes about the Saudi mindset. They think that the U.S. president values money and profit over human rights and the rule of law. They're not really concerned about the response by the Trump administration. I mean, even so far, think about it. The American president, Donald Trump, has not uttered a single negative word, a single negative threat. When Fox News asked Donald Trump about cutting the arms deal to Saudi Arabia, he said, well, we cannot do so. What's involved are billions of dollars, which are very crucial to the U.S. economy. But just to give your, listeners a kind of context, not even 9/11 attacks were able in 2001 created any kind of rupture in Saudi-U.S. relations. Saudi-U.S. relations are not based on values, whether you're talking about human rights or the rule of law. They are transactional. And the relationship goes back to the end of World War II, a relationship based on big business, big money, big arms deals. I mean, Saudi Arabia produces up to 10 million barrels of oil a day. And you have a president who basically has turned business into a sacred affair. It's sacred to him.
But that's all true. But there's not just President Trump. There's Congress. There's the American people. There's other allies. Something like this can't go without a response.
I think you're going to see response on the part of the U.S. Congress, both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are going to freeze temporarily, keep in mind temporarily, freeze some of the arms deals. And I think the war in Yemen, the Congress will unlikely support continued U.S. support. But the reality is, to come to the critical matter, the Trump administration views Saudi Arabia as one of the most important strategic allies in the world, not just in the Middle East.
For the sake of argument, what if President Trump did strike back? What would happen in terms of oil? Would there be a huge impact on the U.S. over oil?
Yes, absolutely. And this is why, I mean, when I say you have a strategic transactional relationship, not just between Saudi Arabia and the United States, between Saudi Arabia and the Western states, you're talking about 10 million of barrels of oil. Yes. You're going to have a huge increase in the cost of oil. So you're going to have major disruption of oil supplies in the world.
Fawaz Jerjiz teaches international relations at the London School of Economics. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
An American student with Palestinian roots is fighting for the right to study in Israel. Lara Al-Qassam is 22. She's been accepted into a graduate program at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and she got a student visa from the Israeli consulate in Miami. It seemed that everything was in order, but when Al-Qassam arrived at the airport in Tel Aviv last week, the authorities refused to let her into the country. The reason was her past involvement with a pro-Palestinian activist group. Reporter Daniela Cheslow went to Al-Qassam's court hearing today and has this story.
Lara Al-Qassam appeared in Tel Aviv District Court this morning. She wore a long black cardigan, a gray turtleneck, black glasses, and she did not say a word. Here's the gist of her legal fight. Israel passed a law in 2017 that allows the government to ban entry to foreign activists who support BDS. That stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions. BDS activists say they want to pressure Israel to promote Palestinian independence. But Israel sees the movement as an anti-Semitic campaign to delegitimize the Jewish state. When Al-Qassam was at the University of Florida, she served as president of a group called Students for Justice in Palestine. That's the smoking gun for Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, Gilad Erdan. He says he will reconsider letting Al-Qassam into Israel if she apologizes for her activism and renounces her support for BDS. So far, she refuses. That's Al-Qassam's lawyer, Yotam Ben-Hillel, speaking in court. He says that she left the activist group a year and a half ago, and in any case, there were only 8 members. He says Al-Qassam never called publicly for a boycott of Israel, and that Israeli officials are relying on Facebook and a dossier from a dodgy anti-Palestinian group to make their case against this American student. State's attorney Yossi Tzadok paints a different picture of Al-Qassam as a committed BDS activist who demonstrated in support of a terrorist. Tzadok also points out that Al-Qassam deleted her social media accounts before she arrived in Israel last week. Asher Fredman is with the Strategic Affairs Ministry.
We're looking at actions. We have clear criteria, and we believe that Ms. Al-Qassam meets those criteria based on her actions and on the actions of the organization of which she was a senior leader over several years.
Al-Qassam's attorney, Liora Bechor, says her client will not apologize.
Lara is not willing to claim that BDS is illegitimate. She's not willing to apologize for her past activities. And the fact that Minister Erdan is asking that of her, he's asking to penalize her thoughts and that she humiliate herself and claim that BDS is illegitimate.
Al-Qassam planned to study at Hebrew University, which has itself been targeted by BDS activists. But the university is supporting Al-Qassam. A lawyer for the school, Pepe Yakirevich, appeared in court and argued that Al-Qassam should be allowed into Israel, where she could see it's not an apartheid state but a democratic country. And Al-Qassam, she says, is just the person who will improve Israel's reputation. The judge didn't give a ruling. Al-Qassam returned to detention. The U.S. Embassy says it's providing consular assistance, including welfare visits, according to an official there. Outside the courtroom, I catch lawmaker Mosi Raz. He and 2 colleagues from the Liberal Merits Party visited Al-Qassam, and he says her situation is unbearable and she must be allowed to study.
I'm afraid that the pressure that the right wing is pressing the court again and again and again make some problems to the just, you know, to the court to decide and to take the just decisions.
One man came to the trial as a spectator. He wore a blue and white Israeli flag draped around his shoulders. Aharon Gottlieb is a Jewish Brazilian who just moved to Israel. And as a Jewish person, he's entitled to citizenship under the law of return.
We need to make sure that our enemies don't come into the country.
That's a view held by many Israelis. Across the street from the court, Malka Weinstein sipped a cappuccino with friends.
All the Western countries don't let such people in their country. If you speak against this country, don't enter there. Go somewhere that you believe in, not the place that you think is bad. It's not Israel that are so racist or against. It's all the countries should defend themselves.
Classes at Hebrew University begin next week. The program Al-Qassem was accepted to is called Human Rights and Transitional Justice. A political cartoon in the Israeli daily Haaretz has pictured Al-Qassem sitting in her detention cell. A guard says to her, "This is the practical part of the course." For The World in Tel Aviv, Daniela Cheslow.
It's so rare to hear a good news story involving Israeli Muslims and Jews, but here's one. An interfaith marriage between two celebrities. Noga Tarnopolsky is a reporter in Jerusalem. We asked her to tell us about the wedding everyone in Israel is talking about.
Lucy Aharish, who's a kind of Israeli sweetheart, I would say. She's a news presenter on TV. She's very smart and very pretty. And in recent years, she's taken an increasingly outspoken role in favor of civil society. Her new husband, Tzachi Halevi, is in some ways the real celeb because he is one of the stars of the TV thriller series Fauda.
And why is this a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal for two reasons. On the simple gossipy level, it's a big deal because these are two very beloved celebrities, and they kept their relationship pretty secret. People who weren't personal friends of theirs didn't make the connection. So when news slipped out last night that they'd gotten married, it caught the general public in a real surprise. But the other is that Aharish comes from a Muslim family. She's an Israeli citizen who is Arab, and Halevi comes from a Jewish family. And these kind of marriages are unusual in Israel. And it also bursts a kind of myth about Israel that interfaith marriages are simply impossible. Their families were both there. This is not a wedding that faced opposition from the intimates of either of the members of the couple. So all of that together.
I mean, how unusual is it?
It's hard to measure. I think there are more couples than one might think, especially couples who don't necessarily get legally married but live together. I know some in my neighborhood in Jerusalem. But the populations don't always blend easily. And mostly there are enormous taboos against that kind of intermarriage. The whole idea of self-definition here is wound up in one's ethnicity. And Islam and Judaism are defined here as ethnic groups, even more than parts of religious practice.
How about in popular culture? I mean, is a mixed marriage also something one doesn't see represented?
I think that among really young Israelis, there's certainly a lot more talk about these kind of couplings than among middle-aged people. But in reality, there have always been, on occasion, these kind of unions, and you always have extremists on both sides who are sometimes in violent opposition. It is completely unusual. In fact, I don't remember an event of a Muslim-Jewish marriage basically getting, you know, the People magazine treatment, Israel version. And that's what's happened this time.
Noga Tarnopolsky is a reporter in Jerusalem. Thanks, Noga.
Thanks to you.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's less than a month till the midterms, and if it seems like the whole country is a political battlefield, well, it's pretty much the case. Republicans and Democrats are in a fierce fight for control of the country's political agenda. And in the age of Trump, the whole world's watching. Among other things, this election season is seeing an unprecedented wave of female candidates, and the trend extends to red states and less prominent offices. The world's Roopa Shenoy spent time with one candidate in Arizona, where rapidly changing demographics have got both parties paying close attention.
I have never wanted to be a candidate. January Contreras swears she never wanted to be doing this, shaking hands and raising money for a campaign, even though she says people urged her to run after she served as an advisor to Janet Napolitano, Arizona's last Democratic governor.
I just think there are many, many ways to serve, and it doesn't have to be as a candidate.
But last year, with President Donald Trump in office and Republicans in control of Congress, Contreras says she felt powerless. Her son Noah remembers when he learned of his mom's plans to change that.
We were at a dinner table, and then Dad said, "We talked this over, and your mom's going to run to be the Attorney General of Arizona."
Noah's a high school freshman who's still rubbing his eyes this Sunday morning. We're in a union hall after one of Contreras' campaign events.
Do you remember what your first reactions were?
Not exactly. What were they?
Your first question was, "What's Attorney General? Why aren't you running for governor?"
That sounds like me, yeah.
And Lucas, do you remember yours?
Her older son, Lucas, is a high school junior.
Lucas's first response was, "What are the commercials going to say about you?"
He worried that political attack ads would target Contreras for being Latina. She's fourth-generation Arizonan and pro-immigrant rights. On the way to another event, a fundraiser in a gated community, Contreras says that was a powerful moment for her. One son asking about the risks people face when running for office, the other asking why she wasn't taking a bigger risk for a more prominent position.
There are a lot of people who don't know what the Attorney General does.
But after serving in the Obama administration and creating a nonprofit that provides free legal services, Contreras, as Attorney General, may help decide things like whether Arizona will try to repeal the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. She wants to keep it. The Republican incumbent, Mark Brnovich, doesn't, and had Arizona join other states that argued the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. Contreras also supports DACA, a program that offers some undocumented immigrants relief from deportation, while Brnovich has battled to keep DACA recipients from getting driver's licenses. Brnovich's campaign didn't respond to interview requests, but this is him on Fox News in March.
Look, I'm a first-generation American. My family fled communism in Eastern Europe, and this fundamental principle about the rule of law is the federal government should not be telling Arizona who they can or can't issue driver's licenses to.
Arizona's a third Latino with some of the strongest pro-immigrant groups in the country. Democrats hope that with Latino candidates like Contreras and David Garcia for governor, more Latinos will vote. And Contreras says she hopes that Latinos see in her someone like them, someone they can trust. But she also knows that Latinos in Arizona don't see themselves as a single group.
We don't always see issues from that lens, but we certainly can see when others are trying to constantly make issues about ethnicity from the other side. And that is, I think, something that we will stand up for and reject, because I think it's clear to a lot of people, including Latinos, that there are people in power right now who want to treat us as second-class citizens.
That may have helped spur record turnout in the primaries last month, with a big showing by Democratic voters. Our Lyft driver tells Contreras he'll be one of them in next month's election. And Contreras is confident as she heads into her fundraiser.
I think it's going to be fun for the rest of the country to watch Arizona and watch us wake up and demand more.
Arizona is a state going through big changes. This will be its first election after Republican Senator John McCain passed away. Senator Jeff Flake's seat is also open. He was openly critical of Trump and won't run again.
I need your support.
Another longtime Arizona figure, former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, was in the running for Flake's seat. He's well known for being tough on undocumented immigrants.
And I know that many people fear me going. They don't have to fear me. I'm a nice guy. I do my job.
But Arpaio was knocked out in the primary. Republican strategist Constantine Carrard acknowledges that Republicans are vulnerable, with some promises unfulfilled.
They have not yet built the wall. They have not yet, you know, gotten rid of Obamacare. And so you have a certain amount of frustration within one party's base and a great deal of energy in the opposition party's base. And that's what can make these midterms a challenge.
But Carrard says Republicans are entrenched in Arizona, and they brought more resources into the state this election cycle, using more database strategies to target voters. Carrard says Trump and his plans for an expanded border wall are popular among GOP voters here, including Latinos.
you know, the, this idea of the Latino vote being this monolithic vote that moves in a single direction really isn't true. The highest ranking Hispanics, Latinos in Arizona over the last several years have all been Republican. And a lot of Hispanics in Arizona who are here legally tend to be some of the strongest advocates for border security. So they don't respond in sort of that knee-jerk fashion that if you're for secure borders, that means you don't like brown people.
So Corrard scoffs at the idea that Latino candidates like Contreras could draw enough new voters for Democrats to win.
And this is a Republican state. She's going to get crushed.
Welcome, January.
At Contreras' fundraiser, which draws a few dozen people, Contreras gets questions about mass incarceration, children in foster care, and immigrant families in detention. Contreras responds that her role as state attorney general is limited, but she'll do what she can and join other attorneys general in their fights against the Trump administration.
I mean, the bottom line is that this is a moment where I'm running for attorney general. This is one line on your ballot. But people in Arizona right now are choosing what version of Arizona they believe in. And will that be an Arizona where we come together, where we are fighting for one another? Or is it going to be an Arizona that adopts this us versus them for a longer period of time?
Some polls show the Arizona Attorney General race as tight. Others give the Republican candidate a clear edge. If Contreras wins, she'll be the first Latina to hold the position. If she loses, she says she'll do what she's always done, find other ways to serve. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Tucson, Arizona.
Coming up, the rare case of an accused Chinese spy apprehended in Belgium and brought to the U.S. to face charges. And when U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods hit workers at a Chinese factory right here in the U.S. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up on The World, the differences between American English and British English that can sow misunderstandings and marital discord.
I'll ask a question and Lynn will say, sure, which to me means I couldn't care less.
It's more than you say tomato, I say tomato. Ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. A Chinese national is in an American jail today. He's being prosecuted on economic espionage charges. This is a big deal. It's the first time a suspected Chinese government spy has been brought to the U.S. to face charges. Yajun Xu is accused of trying to steal technology from GE Aviation through one of their employees. He was caught in a sting operation in Belgium and extradited to the U.S. on Tuesday, according to Justice Department officials. Katie Benner is covering the story for the New York Times. Katie, this is pretty amazing. How did this sting actually go down?
It's unclear whether or not the employee at GE Aviation was working with the government, but it is clear that GE Aviation itself, the subsidiary, was working with the government and was tracking the communications between one of its own employees and this Chinese spy, Mr. Xu. And eventually, Mr. Xu began to ask the employee for more and more information, much of which was proprietary, which the employee himself him or herself recognized. But still, their communications continued, and they eventually agreed to meet while the employee was supposed to be on a business trip in Europe. That allowed the authorities to arrest Mr. Xu while he was not in China, in a country that had an extradition treaty with the United States.
So do we assume the employee was about to go to Belgium and then the authorities came in and said, no, we're actually doing the sting operation? Do we know kind of at the point that the employee was led on that there was going to be a sting operation?
Well, it's unclear whether or not the employee actually went to Belgium, him or herself. We don't know that. And again, we don't know the extent to which the employee was taking part in a sting operation or was just being closely monitored by his or her company. What we do know, though, from our reporters on the ground in Belgium is that Mr. Xu was arrested while he was out just shopping in Belgium. And he claimed that, in fact, he wasn't there to meet anybody but was just on vacation. He remained very quiet. He fought the extradition, which is one of the reasons it took so long to get him from Belgium to the United States. He was arrested on April 1st, April Fool's Day, and he was extradited and arrived in the United States on Tuesday.
Now, this accused spy, Yajun Xu, who is he and what's he supposed to have done?
So Yang Jianshu works for China's lead spy agency, you know, their equivalent of the CIA. And he was supposed to be collecting intelligence for the Chinese government. And one of the ways in which he would do that is he would pose as a representative of a science and technology institute, a think tank that would court the employees of defense contractors to come to China to give talks, to give academic talks and reports, and to do some sort of intellectual exchange. And then once the employees were brought to China, they'd be wined and dined, whereas we all know people can maybe be a little bit too forthcoming with information. Their devices could also be compromised. And at the end of the day, he was also looking for employees like this employee at GE Aviation who at least seemed amenable to giving him information that they shouldn't.
And is he a big fish or a little fish in terms of Chinese intelligence?
Well, I think that it's, even though he was a regional director, it is a huge deal that the United States has charged and arrested this man because he's now going to be tried in open court. So what that means is the government is going to have to bring forth all sorts of very compelling evidence that they've gathered that we don't yet know from the indictment that would prove that this man was not only a spy, but was trying to steal business secrets. That could be horribly embarrassing for the Chinese government, and it could reveal sort of the extent of a larger ring or of a larger scheme.
Now, you mentioned that we don't really know much about the GE Aviation employee. Do we know, is there any details about this person?
No.
Wow. Now, in reading the story, I noticed that there's someone described as an unindicted co-conspirator. Is that the GE Aviation employee or another Chinese figure?
That is not the GE Aviation employee. It's another Chinese figure. And one of the questions is whether or not that figure is a cooperating witness in the government's case.
What's going to happen to Yang Jianshu now, the alleged Chinese spy?
He'll await trial in U.S. court. And he's in a U.S. court, so he's entitled to representation. And I would assume that he would find a very good attorney.
And what's been China's reaction to this?
So far muted, but that could change.
Now, the extradition of Yang Jianshu, it's believed to be a first, but Chinese industrial espionage is nothing new. Why hasn't this kind of arrest and extradition happened before?
Well, we don't have an extradition treaty with China, and technically we can't take their people out of the country. So, you know, in this case, the U.S. government was very lucky to have set up a situation where a Chinese spy was willing to travel to a country with an extradition treaty with the United States. Once we indict Chinese military officials or Chinese government officials, generally it makes public their role in a case, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't allow us to necessarily bring them to open court. It restricts their travel, however, and in some cases it restricts their financial, their ability to move money around.
Katie Benner is with the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So how common is the theft of trade secrets by the Chinese?
In some respects, I think it's overstated, and yet it is prevalent. It does happen.
William Zarrett is chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in China. It's a nonprofit that represents U.S. companies and individuals doing business there. Previously, he was minister for commercial affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing.
When I worked in the U.S. Embassy, we had cases of trade secret theft. And they were not done, actually, however, by folks in the Ministry of Security, but rather by business people for commercial gain. So it was a little bit different.
Yeah, this case involves somebody who seems rather senior. What are the perpetrators usually after?
In some cases, it's technology that is patented. In some cases, it is know-how, which is not patentable, but which is so important for actually producing the product. When I was in the embassy, we had a case of a major with a major U.S. commercial glass company, and employees had actually taken these trade secrets and had used them to build a factory in a third country and were producing products.
Are you able to tell us the name of that company?
I don't think so.
Do you know of cases, though, where American companies who've had things stolen from them, technology and secrets, mm-hmm. have they ever been able to litigate the cases?
As a matter of fact, they have. And the situation is really improving in China. You go back 20 years and the Chinese didn't have much in terms of legislation for protecting intellectual property. But over this period, the legislation has improved quite markedly. Now, enforcement has remained a challenge, but even enforcement is improving. The big exception is in trade secrets. For our companies, that remains probably the biggest area of intellectual property that is difficult to protect.
Why?
Because there isn't proper legislation on this. And I know that the Chinese are working on it. And the U.S., over the years, have worked with the Chinese in capacity building in other areas of IP. And this one seems to be like the last frontier. But we're all working on it still.
What's the threat that comes with trade secret theft? Is it a security threat, an economic one, or both?
Well, I would say in the case that we are reading about of this alleged Ministry of Security person, it's both. In most of the cases in which I was involved, it was really mostly economic. Your technology has been stolen, and products like yours are being produced, and so your market share will shrink.
President Trump's been really vocal about China stealing U.S. intellectual property. I mean, but presumably this has been happening for a while, way before Trump. Is the problem getting worse, or is it just that President Trump has decided to be more vocal about it than previous presidents?
It's the latter. I don't see that the problem is getting worse. And in some ways, I think this trade friction that we're now in the middle of this, I think that the real crux of this issue is reciprocal treatment. Yes, IP violations have been going on for a long time, and the U.S. has talked with China for years about this, but we have never before applied pressure. You know, I feel that we've had this grand bargain with China for a long time in which we knew these things were going on and we would talk with the Chinese about it, and yet we wouldn't apply the leverage because we were also benefiting from the relationship. We were getting less expensive goods. Consumers were happy. Companies were making money. Even political leaders, their voters, were getting a less expensive product and stretching dollars. And it just came to a tipping point. And so now we're applying pressure. So I think the approach that we're taking, we have to, the U.S. that is, has to come with the idea that, okay, you've been doing these things, but we have been more or less complicit because we really didn't apply pressure until very recently.
William Zaret is chairman of the nonprofit American Chamber of Commerce in China. He's been speaking to us from Beijing. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
More now on the strained business relationships between Chinese companies and the U.S., only this story is mostly about the effect of tariffs on American workers. A few years ago, Massachusetts wanted to make a big order for new subway cars for the Boston area. But there was one stipulation. They had to be made in Massachusetts. Enter the Chinese Railway Rolling Stock Corporation, or CRRC. The company won the contract and built a factory about 100 miles from Boston. Well, that was before the new trade war between the U.S. and China under President Trump. Now the future of the factory and its well-paid workers is in doubt. Adam Riley from our partners here at WGBH in Boston has the story.
When you pull up to the CRRC plant in Springfield, Massachusetts, the first thing you notice is the size. 200,000 square feet sprawled over a once vacant lot. Step inside and you see just a fraction of that space is currently in use, though the activity there is intense. Right now, CRRC's workers are building six cars for Boston's transit system. By 2020, they'll be sending eight new cars per month, eventually delivering more than 400. That's good news for riders used to shabby digs, and even better news for workers like Eric Anderson.
I was a cook. Been a cook for about 7 years.
Then CRRC, a massive state-owned Chinese company, opened this facility on Springfield's east side. Anderson got an assembly job and a significant pay hike.
It probably doubled with the benefits from what I was making.
Also reaping the benefits, Ian Bissett, who moved from Vermont for his job as a lead mechanical assembler.
If I'm perfectly honest, it blows anything out of the water that's up there currently that I'm aware of. Especially in this field.
The coming years should bring more solid blue-collar jobs like theirs to Springfield, as CRRC builds subway cars not just for Boston, but also for Philadelphia and L.A. But now there's a hitch, significant uncertainty linked to President Trump's escalating trade war with China.
Yeah, so far, the new tariffs and the new policies have left an impact on our manufacturing and also on CRRC.
Jia Bo, who spoke with us through an interpreter, is the vice president of CRRC's Massachusetts operation. He says since some of the parts used here are imported from China, the Trump administration's tariffs have added millions in new costs. There's also bipartisan interest in banning CRRC from bidding on federal projects, and even talk of labeling the company a national security threat. Critics say CRRC underbids to gain market dominance, and that technology on its vehicles could be used for surveillance. But Jia insists that the company is a force for good.
CRRC is definitely here in the United States to stay. We have a long growing plan, and we're definitely bringing benefits for the taxpayers here.
That said,
from 2021, the job creation will slip from there if there's no additional new orders coming on board regarding to the new tariffs and the new restrictions on the company.
Which is why politicians like Springfield Mayor Dominic Sarno and Democratic Congressman Richard Neal want the Trump administration to reconsider. Also hoping the president shifts course, John Scavato.
You know, at this day and age in Springfield, we need the manufacturing. We haven't had manufacturing here in years.
Scavato is the business agent for Sheet Metal Workers Local 63, and he's thrilled by CRRC's embrace of union labor.
There's over 120 union workers from Springfield, Americans.
But now, he says, Trump's approach is jeopardizing that.
You're going to possibly put them out of work. If they can't get contracts, they can't, you know, maintain this building. And I do believe he wants to put people to work, but yet I don't think he realizes the impact of what he's doing over here.
Then again, CRRC now plans to circumvent Trump's tariffs by shifting the production of certain parts from China to the U.S., which could mean more new jobs, not less, and convince the president's supporters he knows exactly what he's doing. For The World, Adam Riley, Springfield, Massachusetts.
We take another look at trade tomorrow, only this story will be all about North America, dairy farmers, and President Trump.
Canada, what they've done to our dairy farm workers is a disgrace.
Trump made good on his promise to replace NAFTA by drafting a new trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. His big focus was on selling more U.S. dairy products in Canada. So tomorrow on The World, we talk with a Canadian dairy farmer about how the new trade deal looks from up north.
He said we were hurting their dairy farmers. Well, the Americans had a $600 million surplus with us, but he got into his head that we were mistreating their farmers.
Turns out the big problem for America's dairy farmers is not Canadian tariffs. Our reporter learns about the real threat to America's dairy industry. That's right here tomorrow. The long-running BBC sci-fi drama Doctor Who is back on TV.
Carl's the data. That's what it was gathering on the train.
But what would the alien want with him?
Which one of you shall I kill first?
Episode 2 of the new season airs this Sunday on BBC America, and there's a brand new Doctor. It's the 13th actor to play the Time Lord and the first woman.
Hold on there, please, madam. I need you to do as I say. This could be a potential crime
scene. Why call me madam?
Because you're a woman?
She's played by Jodie Whittaker, and some American viewers are having trouble understanding her Yorkshire English.
Sorry, half an hour ago I was a white-haired Scotsman. When's the next train due?
The World's Patrick Cox isn't from Yorkshire, but he is from Britain. Patrick, you're married to an American, you have an American kid. Does your family ever have trouble understanding you?
Oh, for many reasons, Carol. And occasionally I blame it on my British English, which is kind of surprising. You know, I mean, I thought the world, especially the English-speaking world, was so global now that we could basically all understand each other. But no, I talked with a family who are kind of the mirror image of mine, an American woman and a British man who live in the UK, Lynn Murphy and Phil Viner.
So we met in England, and she'd only been here about 1 year.
2 years.
2 years.
That was 16 years ago. Like all couples, their communication hasn't always been smooth.
I'll ask a question and Lim will say, sure. Which to me means I couldn't care less. I just hear it as a no, whereas...
I see it as a yes.
Good luck with that, Americans.
We mean it as a yes, and it's taken as a, oh, I'm really unenthusiastic about that.
Like a shrug.
You decide. Yeah, exactly. It's a linguistic shrug, and I do find it annoying.
I mean, to me, what sure means is, well, I hadn't had that idea, but that sounds fine to me. But Phil will second guess that every time I say it.
Yeah, and that, I imagine that comes up quite often.
It actually does.
Lynn and Phil live in Brighton on the south coast of England. They have a just about to turn 11-year-old daughter, Arden. Okay, Arden, here's the question that everybody asks you if you do a BBC interview at the beginning. They say, what did you have for breakfast today? Tell me.
I had a bagel.
So American. There was I expecting to hear beans on toast or something.
And what was in your bagel?
Egg.
Fried egg bagel.
Fried egg bagel.
With ketchup.
Which I think it is an abomination.
Yeah, that is a bit of an abomination.
My mum does not like ketchup with eggs. She thinks it's wrong.
This is a family separated by a common condiment. They're also, of course, separated by a common language, which happens to be the title of Lynn's blog, Separated by a Common Language. And this year, her book came out. It's called The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. So now you know why I wanted to hear from the rest of Lynn's family, why I asked Lynn if she'd bring Phil and Arden with her to talk to me, and why Lynn said, sure. Another deceptively complex expression is middle class.
I think it's a minefield.
Phil's been a regular visitor to the US even before he met Lynn, but he still doesn't fully understand how and when Americans use middle class.
It really isn't the same as the middle class I know from Britain.
Yeah, I mean, middle class in the United States seems something that politicians use an awful lot. I mean, Bill Clinton used it constantly.
I propose a middle class Bill of Rights.
It seems to be sort of just this aspirational state.
In America, you'd be sort of ashamed not to call yourself middle class. If you called yourself anything else, you'd be self-conscious about it. Whereas in Britain, if you call yourself middle class, you have to be very self-conscious about it. It's not a badge of honor. It's a badge of mild embarrassment.
And those girls taught me all about what it means to be middle class. They taught me all about middle class life. Flat whites, smashed avocado on toast. Have you got a pale rosé? We're looking for a really pale rosé.
And it can be an insult in some places. You know, you can attack somebody by saying that they're middle class, especially if they've come from somewhere deeply working class. It can be that they've betrayed their roots in some ways.
Yeah. So Americans might think, when I say it's embarrassing to call yourself middle class, Americans might think it's embarrassing because it's too low. But no, it's too high. In Britain, to call yourself middle class is to put on airs.
It might just be easier if we spoke different languages. Making mistakes would be more forgivable then. And remember, if you're surrounded by people who don't speak the same way as you, you will hear about it. And over time, you'll probably make adjustments.
When Arden was 2.5, she said to me, "You say bath and Daddy says bath." And I said, "What are you going to say?" And she said, "Bath."
What do you do in the bath?
And I thought, why in the world do they call it the mother tongue? Because I get nothing as the mother here. She's going to speak the English of the English. It's very clear that I am the odd one out in our milieu. She's got grandparents with a different accent from mine. She's got a dad with a different accent from mine. She's got teachers and friends. I'm the odd one out. I'm not the one to be imitated.
Except when we go over to America, I always feel a bit self-conscious about my accent because I speak different to most other people.
But I think you'll slide into saying Beth quite quickly.
It's a bit embarrassing being told my accent's cute all the time.
I know the feeling.
Yeah, or the people who say, I could just listen to you all day, and you think, and not take in a word I'm saying.
Lynn Murphy, Phil Viner, and their daughter Arden.
Now, Patrick, I have to ask, does Lynn think American and British English is getting any closer?
This is the question she gets asked more than anything else. And in certain areas, she says, it most certainly is. But she doesn't buy the idea, which a lot of Brits buy into, that American English is, quote, taking over in Britain. Firstly, there are tons of British English words that actually have moved in the opposite direction, whether it's, you know, words like cheers or gobsmacked or row in the sense of an argument. Or here's an interesting one, to vet. This has been around in Britain for hundreds of years. Only in the past few decades have Americans started using it. The thing is, some British regional dialects, like the one that you heard in Doctor Who, they are fading away. But Lynn says it's not Americanisms that are taking over in those cases, it's Londonisms.
Hmm.
But who wants to blame Londoners when Americans are available for blame?
Indeed. The world's Patrick Cox, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Carol.
And that's it for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.